to them. But life would be dire for the other boys, who would continue in their criminal ways. Their disgusted families would cease to visit them in jail, and when they were released as old, broken men, they would die on the pavement, unloved. The master cried for parents who beat their children instead of taking time to reason with them. Intriguingly, he also cried about his divorce, and how his wife had been a bitch to his mother, and how in the settlement he'd lost a big car. He cheered up when talking about his pretty new girlfriend. Whenever the man cried, whether for the loss of his car or for the fates of Dongri inmates, the boy started crying too. Abdul had never in his life wept as he wept now. The tears weren't the kind he'd shed after being beaten by the Sahar police. These were tears of inspiration. He'd never encountered a man as refined and honest as this master. Abdul was reluctant to name the feeling he had, listening to the man, because it could be taken wrong. But what he felt for the master was intense. The man had allowed him to become a student. Not a great student. He didn't quite get the Hindu myth about King Shibi offering up his own flesh to an eagle, which seemed not unlike a story that his father used to tell him when he'd misbehaved about a different king and his scoundrel sons and a monkey. But his father's king story had left him feeling guilty. The master's words lit up a virtuous path. Be generous and noble. Offer up your flesh. Agree to be eaten by the eagles of the world, and justice will come to you in time. It was a painful way to go through life, but Abdul was drawn to the happy ending. He assessed himself to have been virtuous in some ways. He had resisted Erase X, Desi liquor, brothel visits, or other diversions he felt might impinge on his alertness and ability to work. He refused to encourage other boys to steal things, even if it meant losing out to the Tamil who owned the game shed and maximized his profits by lending out wire-cutting tools. Abdul never fought, lied only sometimes, rarely voiced resentment of his father. But he could have been better and more honorable. He still could be. He would categorically refuse to buy anything he thought had been stolen, even if it was only stolen garbage. He wouldn't admit to something he hadn't done to Fatima, even if it would get him out of Dongri, even if his family's income suffered in his absence. To his family, Abdul's physical capability had been the mattering thing. He was the workhorse, his moral judgments irrelevant. He wasn't even sure that he had any moral judgments. But when the master spoke of tawfiz and izzat, respectability and honor, Abdul thought the man's stare had blazed across the rows of heads and come to rest on him alone. It was not too late, at 17 or whatever age he was, to resist the corrupting influences of his world and his nature. An awkward, uneducated boy might still be capable of righteousness. He intended to remember this and every other truth the master spoke. Part 3. A Little Wildness.
You won't sell anything if you talk about debt.
Manju Wagekar.
Chapter 9. Marquee Effect. In July, when Asha and her family stepped off the train after a 13-hour journey north to the Vidarbha region of Maharashtra, their village relatives inspected their faces, finding evidence of how good life was in the Mumbai slums.
"You're all fairer than you were when you were little,"
noted a cousin of Manju, Rahul and Ganesh.
"Smooth type, chikna. You were very black before and shy."
To examine Asha properly, the older women had to crane their necks since their bodies were bent from decades of agricultural labor. Asha's great-grandmother walked on all fours. Looking at the ancient woman, Asha stood mast straight. She felt like a giantess coming home. In Anawadi, she wept buckets when village movies played on the Marathi language channels. Even the corniest of the flood and famine dramas swept her back to her own early years, working Vidarbha's difficult earth. In her occasional recountings to her children, she kept the tone absurdist, a manic teenage version of Mother India, dragging the plow after the oxen had died. The women of her village recalled the Asha of that era with respect.
She'd been distinguished by her ability to work like a donkey, even when she hadn't eaten for days.
She was one bone thin, half starving, when we were working the orange groves,
one of her relatives whispered to the others.
You wouldn't know it now. She's a double bone, and the way she talks, you'd think she'd never trod on dirt.
Asha was glad to be the subject of admiring chatter, and to be away from the troubles of Unnawadi. She had come home to market her beautiful daughter and her own relative prosperity among the people of her farming caste, the Kunbis. Her husband, Mahadeo, would play sober. She would play deferential wife. Manju would play herself, and marriage offers would, by all rights, roll in, despite the nominal occasion of the visit. This occasion was a stripped-down family wedding. No music, no dancing, no jalebis. The groom, one of Mahadeo's nephews, was still in mourning for his elder brother, who had died of AIDS shortly after infecting his wife. The disease was rampant in Vidarbha, and vigorously denied. If word got out that it had claimed one of Manju's relatives, it might diminish her value as a bride. But people in the village weren't terribly interested in the young man's death, or in the widow hidden away for the duration of the festivities, or even in Asha's stories of the city. The farmer's eyes kept turning to the sky. The break in the rains, as it was called in Unnawadi, had a different name in the countryside. Drought. Little rain had fallen in June, and millions of cotton seedlings planted the previous month had died. The villagers had paid a steep price for their seeds, genetically modified ones called hybrids, theoretically designed for Vidarbha's erratic climate. Now more seeds would have to be sown, and new loans arranged to pay for them. Some Kunbis said that July was the month when the gods slept. Asha's relatives hoped the gods had changed their schedules this year, and were also awake nights, worrying. In the 2 decades since Asha and her husband left their respective farming villages, 20 miles apart, much had changed for the better. Some houses had grown larger and sturdier, thanks to the money those who'd left for the city sent back home. Public money had also altered the landscape. Scattered among desiccated farms were new schools, colleges, and handsome government offices with lawns as well tended as those of the Airport Road Hyatt. The government had built more water projects, too, but these had failed to compensate for the decline of Vidarbha's natural water systems. Poor rains and illegal siphoning depleted the water table. Streams dried up. Rivers reversed course. As fish died and crops failed, moneylenders became unofficial village chiefs. Ashamed and in debt, some farmers killed themselves. An old story, one of the Marathi movie staples. But the movie reel was still playing. In the new century, the government counted an average of 1,000 farmer suicides a year in Vidarbha. Activists counted many more. Whatever the number, the suicides had turned the region into international shorthand for the desperation of rural Indian poverty. The files accumulating dust in the record rooms of the Vidarbha bureaucracy indicated that modern means of suicide, drinking pesticide mainly, had supplanted self-immolation. Over thousands of mildewed pages, relatives described their loved ones' distress.
Last 2 years we had crop failure. He could not repay his loan. Then came a fire in the hut. All the seeds got burned, sunflower, wheat, destroyed. He couldn't afford to marry his second son, and people would keep asking when the marriage would happen.
His family was so big, and after looking at bank documents, he was disturbed and drank insecticide. The loan was huge, and he didn't see how he could pay.
He was slow-minded, short on his lights, and worked the fields, then took loans for the daughter's wedding, and felt trapped.
He said, "Father, I will kill myself if you don't buy me a cell phone." Then he went and drank the poison.
The Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, had come down from Delhi to express his concern for the farmer's hardship and the central government's determination to relieve it. The families of some indebted suicides would get government compensation, and a debt restructuring and interest waiver program had begun for the farmers who had borrowed from banks instead of moneylenders. A massive national scheme to increase rural incomes was also underway, guaranteeing unemployed villagers 100 days a year of publicly subsidized work.
One of the government's hopes was to stop villagers from abandoning their farms and further inundating cities like Mumbai. But Asha's relatives knew nothing of these celebrated relief programs. Among powerful Indians, the distribution of opportunity was typically an insider trade. Elsewhere that summer, public telecom licenses worth the equivalent of tens of billions of dollars were being sold to the highest under-the-table corporate bidder. Public funds meant to build world-class sports facilities for the 2010 Commonwealth Games were being diverted to private interests. Parliamentary opposition to the future of a landmark India-United States nuclear treaty was being softened by trunks full of cash. And the combined wealth of the 100 richest Indians was surging to equal nearly a quarter of the country's GDP. In a forested stretch of Vidarbha east of where Asha and her husband had grown up, many citizens had stopped believing the government's promises about improving their fortunes. Deprived of their land and historical livelihoods by large-scale corporate and government modernization projects, they'd helped revive a 40-year-old movement of Maoist revolutionaries. Employing landmines, rocket launchers, nail bombs, and guns against capitalism in the Indian state, the guerrillas were now at work in roughly one-third of India's 627 districts, including an underdeveloped swath of central and eastern India known as the Red Belt. This summer, the Maoists had been especially productive in the state of Orissa. They'd sunk a boat full of military commandos, killing 38, and bombed a police van, killing 21 more. In most rural villages, however, people weren't yet talking revolution. They were waiting to see if improvements in infrastructure and agricultural technology might change their prospects. This year, as Manju's 17-year-old cousin Anil labored in the cotton and soybean fields, he carried one such advance on his back, a heavy metal canister of Dow pesticide. The fields on which he worked belonged to a rich politician who paid his laborers 1,000 rupees, or $21, a month. While the politician's crop yield and profit increased with the new chemicals, the freight of the canisters and the noxious inhalations made the laborers work, never easy, blisteringly hard. At the end of a recent workday, one of Anil's co-workers had set down his canister, climbed a tree at the edge of the farm, and hanged himself. His family received no government compensation for the loss. At night, Anil had many imaginary conversations with the politician for whom he worked, in which he gently argued that more difficult labor be rewarded by slightly higher pay. A complaining worker was easily replaced, though. Anil kept his thoughts, including the suicidal ones, to himself. "Try your luck in Anawadi," Asha had suggested the previous year. And so Anil had become one of the roughly 500,000 rural Indians who annually arrived in Mumbai. Each dawn, he stood with other work-seekers at Meral Naka, an intersection near the airport where construction supervisors came in trucks to pick up day laborers. 1,000 unemployed men and women came to this crossroads every morning. A few hundred got chosen for work. Anil didn't know that life expectancy in Mumbai was 7 years shorter than in the nation as a whole. He just knew that at the intersection, trying unsuccessfully to compete with all the other migrants, he felt as if his chest were stuffed with straw. After a month of rejection, he'd gone home.
"People laugh to see me back," he now told Manju. "I had told them I was going to earn money and see the city, and I didn't do either. Only major thing I saw were airplanes."
The night before the wedding, Manju, in her position as the oldest female of her generation, carried a pot of grains through the village to the temple where prayers would be said for the bride and groom. In a peach-sequined chiffon tunic that her aunt in the city had tired of, she led a parade of family and neighbors along dirt roads full of scavenging donkeys. Past some mud-and-dung houses painted a shade of green no longer known in the fields, she clambered up a steep path to the temple of Hanuman, the monkey god. Earlier, she'd powdered the groom's face and added glitter around his eyes with a toothbrush. But even in the dark, unelectrified temple, she could feel people's eyes following her, not the sparkle-caked groom. An urban, college-going girl was a firework in the village. But which of the Kunbi men would Asha choose to be her husband? Some of them would consider Manju too educated to be docile. others would be too poor to sustain her mother's interest. Manju failed in her efforts to track Asha's movements at the glum wedding the following day, but soon after, a young soldier appeared at the house where the family was staying. Asha went outside to speak to him privately. From time to time, Manju could hear her mother's hoarse laugh. Recently in Annawadi, Manju had watched Asha negotiate the marriage between a shy neighbor girl and a boy from another slum. Manju had been excited at the chance to glimpse the sort of negotiations that would one day decide her own future. It had seemed to be going well, until the girl lifted her head.
"Not beautiful,"
the boy's family had objected, blaming Asha for wasting their time. The harsh pragmatism of that afternoon had armed Manju, so when Asha called for her to bring out tea, she smoothed her hair, lowered her eyes, and tried to keep her heart ice cold. Taking his cup, the soldier stared at her for a long moment and said,
"Don't stand in the sun. You'll get too black."
He wasn't bad-looking, despite the mustache, and Manju's eyes were not so lowered that she failed to note his own eyes sliding down her body. She felt as if she'd been touched. It sometimes disturbed her how strongly she wanted to be wanted. She felt very nearly ready for marriage. For sex. But if Asha arranged any marriage that sentenced her to a life in Vidarbha, Manju had decided that she would run away. One night before the family returned to Annawadi, Anil told his cousins of a dream he'd had. He was sprinting away from the farm, and Manju, Rahul, and Ganesh were running alongside him.
"We were all escaping, and our mothers were angry. They were saying, 'If you go, we won't let you come back.' And we were saying, 'Don't call us back. We don't want to come back. We're going somewhere better.' We were laughing so hard as we ran."
Back at Annawadi, Asha shut the sordid Fatima drama out of her mind and shut her door on the frantic Zerunisa. She wanted to devote the rest of the monsoon season to self-improvement. For one, she needed to take a college course or two, or she would lose her temp job teaching kindergarten at Merrill Municipal School. The government of Maharashtra had been trying to increase the quality of its schools, and some of the teachers were being pressured to show they were trying to get an education themselves. Fortunately, Asha's professor at Yashwantrao Chavan Maharashtra Open University had assured his class of teachers that he would provide answers to the end-of-year papers and exams. But Asha wanted to be a politician, not a low-paid kindergarten teacher. To achieve this goal, she thought she'd have to shed her slum ways as she'd shed her village ones. It was a second kind of migration, of class. The key, she told Manju, was
to study the first-class people. You see how they're living, how they walk, what they do. And then you do the same.
Asha had raised her daughter to believe that she was different from the other children in Annawadi, superior even to her own brothers. At 14, Ganesh was gentle and hesitant, while Rahul, for all his confidence, lacked ambition. Having given up on hotel work, he was perfectly content with his new temp job, clearing tables at a canteen for airport employees. More and more, Asha could see her husband in the boys. Having taught them what she thought they could learn, they were now among the fastest male onion dicers in Annawadi. She let them be. Only she and Manju seemed capable of the intelligent planning that might help carry them into India's expanding middle class. Asha remembered how it was when her neighbors heard that she'd gotten a kindergarten post with only a seventh grade education. They called her teacher, snidely. Over time, however, the title stuck and the mockery melted away. Similarly, you could pose as a member of the Overcity, wait out the heckles, and become one. It was another form of the by-harding that Manju did at school.
"And don't be afraid to talk to the first-class people directly. Some of them are quite nice. They'll speak back,"
Asha instructed her daughter.
"Inquire of them how to look better. Take their advice."
Recently, Asha had asked a Shiv Sena man to make a rigorous critique of her image.
"He says don't wear shoes with heels when you have height, because it cheapens you," she reported to Manju. "Don't wear your house dress outside. Wear a sari instead. Put your Mangalsutra on a long chain, not a short one. Don't look as if you're worried, even if you are. No one wants to look at such lines on your face. And don't walk with people who look worse than you.
The Shiv Sena man had been a little blunt conveying that last tip. She had been walking with him to the corporator's house one evening, and he'd said,
I am looking nice, and you are looking ugly, and your ugliness takes away from me too.
Manju brought additional information home from college. Dangling earrings, low class. Tiny hoops, high class. High-class women also wear jeans, she told her mother, who subsequently sanctioned a pair of bell-bottoms. One day, looking in the mirror at how the jeans worked with the peach-sequined second-hand tunic, Manju said aloud to herself,
Maki effect.
She'd learned the term in computer class, practicing Photoshop. The marquee effect dimmed a bit when Asha's sister gave both mother and daughter haircuts with feathery bangs. In the humidity, the feathers rose in a great cloud of frizz. But it was fun, spending the monsoon getting modern. Sensing her mother suddenly treating her as an equal, Manju broached a new subject, that many first-class people married outside their own caste, to people they, not their parents, had chosen.
Rich people all have this different mindset, Manju said.
Asha didn't want to get as first-class as that. Asha had liked the soldier from Vidarbha, who came from a relatively affluent family, but her husband had objected to the engagement on the unlikely grounds that army men were often drunks like himself. In Anawadi, Sister Paulette had visited Asha twice now to lobby on behalf of another potential groom, a middle-aged man who lived in Mauritius.
He's my brother,
the nun said, eyes blinking fast. Asha suspected Sister Paulette was operating on commission. Asha was too, in a way. Most Anawadians consider daughters a liability, given the crushing financial burden of the dowry. But it had long ago occurred to Asha that a girl as beautiful, capable, and self-sacrificing as Manju might make a marriage so advantageous it would lift up her whole family. The Mauritius man was rich, supposedly, but Asha was uneasy about sending her only daughter to Africa, where she'd heard that pretty girls got sold into slavery. She decided not to decide, for now. Instead, she encouraged Manju to widen her social circle, which would increase the odds of a superior offer. Asha believed a person seeking betterment should try as many schemes as possible, since it was hard to predict which one might work. Manju's first idea had been to sell insurance, as one of her college classmates had done. The Life Insurance Corporation of India was offering free training to aspiring agents in an office building down the road from the Hotel Leela. Asha was intrigued by the television ads for this insurance, which allowed those who could afford it to insulate themselves from some of the volatility of Indian life. The young husband in one of the commercials had cared enough to buy medical insurance for his wife before the traffic accident. Now, miraculously, she was rising from her wheelchair. Life insurance was turning funerals into celebrations. Selling such policies would put Manju in touch with affluent people while bringing more money to the household. The children in Manju's hut school came early to support her as she learned the English names of the policies. Future confidence, too. Wealth confident, invest confident, aspire life. The children's vocabularies momentarily expanded to include the terms surrender value, rider premium, and partial withdrawal. In training, Manju learned that she wouldn't sell anything if she referred directly to tragedy or death. You had to emphasize the profit angle. Tell the story of a man who bought 40 policies and left his family eye-high in rupee notes. Manju practiced her pitches and rebuttals until she was fluent, and passed the final exam with high marks. Then, nothing. Who did she know who could afford to buy insurance?
Everybody wants their profit, she told the children one day, shaking her head. They say, if I do this, how much will I make? In college, the girls talk like that, even when they're talking about each other. Why talk to that weird girl, Pallavi? What's the profit? What's the use?
The brothel keeper's 11-year-old daughter, Zubbu, understood Manju's concern with profit obsession better than the other children. Her parents were trying to sell her, and the girl felt as if she were going mad. Manju could only pray that Zubu's parents would be as unsuccessful in this entrepreneurial venture as they were in all their other ones. Teaching girls like Zubu, Manju felt her own luck. Next spring, if she passed her state board exams, she'd have a BA degree. With another year of study to be financed by selling one of the rented rooms in their hut, she'd be a qualified teacher with a BED. She had no hope of securing a permanent job at a government school, since such jobs typically required paying enormous bribes to education officials. Small private schools were a likelier bet, although most of them paid so little that her classmates in the BA-BED program had begun to worry that they'd invested in a chump profession. One girl intended to work at a call center upon graduation. Another figured she'd make more money as a chef. Manju alone in the group still wanted to teach. But the Anawadi hut school where she honed her skills was irritating her mother more by the day. Asha didn't see a long-term benefit in networking with low-class children. The central government funded Manju's bridge school and hundreds like it in Mumbai through contracts with non-profit organizations. Although public funds for education had increased with India's new wealth, the funds mainly served to circulate money through the political elite. Politicians and city officials helped relatives and friends start non-profits to secure the government money. It was of little concern to them whether the schools were actually running. Manju's school came under the auspices of a Catholic charity, Reach Education Action Program, or REAP, that took its obligation to poor students more seriously than some other non-profits did. The priest who headed the organization resisted paying kickbacks, and his schools were gradually being shut across Mumbai. The Anawadi school was one of the survivors, and a supervisor for the charity came every month or so to sit in on the class and examine the records. He'd caught on that the school Asha was supposed to be running was really being taught by Manju, but he'd let it slide because her students were learning. One afternoon, the children were mastering the English words chariot, knee, mirror, fish, and hand. "And what do you do with these hands of yours?" Manju wanted to know.
"Eat, wash clothes, fill water, dance. Raise them to show somebody I'm going to beat him up."
Heads turned. Asha was in the doorway, enraged.
"How urgent is this teaching?" she shouted at Manju. "What is more important, these children or keeping this house in order for me?"
Dirty children were sprawled on the floor. Notebooks were scattered about. It was a scene unbefitting the home of an almost slumlord and aspiring elected official. Supplicants would be arriving momentarily to present their problems to Asha. The morning's laundry was damp.
"Wonderful," Asha said to Manju, feeling a towel. "You put the clothes on the string inside when the sun is shining outside. Can't you do one thing properly in my absence?"
Manju turned away to keep her students from seeing her face. After that, Manju began teaching her class every other day, or every third day. The children understood that the choice was not her own. When a new school opened in the Pink Temple by the sewage lake, many of them gravitated to it, but it closed as soon as the leader of the non-profit had taken enough photos of children studying to secure the government funds. In Manju's newly free time, she pursued a second idea for widening her social networks. She joined the Indian Civil Defense Corps, a group of middle-class citizens trained to save others in the event of floods or terror attacks. Like many people in Mumbai, she was increasingly concerned about terrorism. In July, there had been bomb blasts in Bangalore, then blasts in Ahmedabad. 19 explosions in the heart of the city. The bombers weren't Maoists. Maoists were rural India's problem. The urban hazard was religious militants, some of them acting in the name of Allah, as they wrote in their emails to newspapers. Mumbai, the financial capital, was an obvious target, so sniffer dogs joined the security phalanxes at the five-star hotels. At the airport, sandbag bunkers proliferated. On the Western Express Highway, electronic signboards urged the citizenry to be alert. "Stranger in your area? Call police." The Civil Defense Corps seemed to Manju a more substantial way to protect her city than calling the police about strangers. In the cavernous basement of a government building, she and 40 other Maharashtrians, middle-aged women and two idealistic college boys, simulated crises and practiced techniques for saving lives.
In a bomb blast, stay calm and make sure you are safe first. Then calm the others and lead them to safety. In a flash flood, pumpkins and empty plastic water bottles may be used as flotation devices. Tie your dupatta to someone too weak to swim and pull them behind you.
Of the cadre, Manju was the slenderest and too weak for the all-important farmer's lift. So her usual assignment in the training exercises was to be deadweight, the injured object of rescue. Splayed on the linoleum floor, hair fanned, she worked all the distress moves she could think of from Hindi movies, from the chest heave to the terrified eye flit to the old sigh and tremble. Then she'd get thrown over someone's shoulder and carried to safety. Being touched was permissible here, and loveliest when she let her body relax in the arms of Vijay, an earnest, square-jawed college boy who led the battalion. He appreciated the sincere effort Manju put into being a victim. One night, as Manju left the training in her new jeans and the peach tunic, Vijay called her name. As they crossed the road to the bus stop together, he gripped her hand, her first time. Manju's hopes pressed against her well-honed tendency toward realism, which insisted that the city's Vijays had better options than a not-yet-first-class girl. It was hard to keep secrets in a slum. As Asha understood, secrets successfully kept were a kind of currency. People could say what they liked about where she went at night and what she did with whom, but until they caught her, she was going to deny it. Now it was the night of her 40th birthday, a scant moon in a low sky, no rain. Manju passed out slices of cake, a heap of potato chips on the side, and Asha put her arms around her sons. Even her husband, Mahadeo, was in a celebratory mood as he plundered one of her gifts, a plastic treasure chest filled with gold-wrapped chocolate coins.
"They should have been real coins, since it's my 40th," Asha said, smiling as she set into her cake.
Her cell phone rang again. It had been ringing for most of the last 15 minutes, and she'd been enfolding it ever deeper into the lap of her dark blue sari. A police officer named Wag was impatient to see her.
"An emergency?" Manju asked after a while. "Calling so many times?" "It's that woman Rina, Shaka work,"
Asha lied. "Shiv Sena women's wing business." Then a minute later, she said, uncertainly,
"Maybe I will need to go."
"What? Tell her you can't come. It's your birthday party,"
Manju commanded cheerfully, just before Asha answered the phone.
"Can't,"
she said into the receiver. Long pause.
"No, not possible. Tomorrow? You see..."
Long pause.
"Listen, I..."
Suddenly she was standing at the mirror, powdering her cheeks with talcum, adjusting her sari, combing her thick hair off her face. She could see her husband and Manju staring at her through the mirror.
"My necklace must look real,"
she chattered, nervous.
"A guy at the train station today told me to put it away or it would get stolen. Did you know coriander is only 5 rupees at the Ghat Kopar market? I went to my friend's house for tea there earlier, then missed the bus. Good fresh coriander, better than we get here."
"Mother," said Manju quietly. "Don't go."
The cell phone rang again. Asha said,
"Yes, I said I'm coming. I am hurrying. But where?"
The talcum powder was all over the cell phone, streaking down her neck. She was sweating. Her husband's eyes had filled with tears.
"Mother,"
Manju said again, reaching for her hand.
"Please, mother."
But Asha spun out of her daughter's grasp, walked fast across the Maidan, past the road boys in the video parlor, past the Hyatt, not pausing until she reached the bus stop outside the imperious Grand Maratha Hotel. This pink hotel was the most expensive of the lot. Golden pink now, as hundreds of lights illuminated the curves of its Jaipur stone front. Asha glowed too, standing on the other side of the fence, a slash of white talc across one cheek. She suspected, rightly, that at home, Manju's tears were falling on a slice of chocolate cake. For years, Asha had hoped that her daughter wouldn't guess about the men. Now she wished she had raised Manju to be worldly enough to understand. This wasn't about lust or being modern, though she knew that many first-class people slept around. Nor was it just about feeling loved and beautiful. This was about money and power. Her mind moved more quickly than other people's. The politicians and policemen had eventually recognized this dexterity, come to depend on it. Even so, it had not been enough. At 20, she was a poor, uneducated refugee from the droughtlands whose husband had no appetite for work. Tonight, at 40, she was a kindergarten teacher and the most influential woman in her slum. A woman who had given her daughter a college education and soon, she hoped, a brilliant marriage. The flourishing of Manju alone had justified the trade-offs, even the nightmares about dying of AIDS. She should get the blood test done. She knew that. She should be watching Airport Road for the arrival of the officer. But a society wedding was spilling out onto the Grand Maratha's lawn. This day was an auspicious one in the Hindu calendar, astrologist certified for weddings, she had forgotten. A brass band was playing music she didn't recognize. Paparazzi were jostling for photos, blocking her view of the bride. Bits of red and pink confetti blew over the fence and landed at her feet, before the gusts winged them off. A white police van pulled up. For her. Asha slowly turned from the lights and the band and the celebration as the back door of the van slid open. Chapter 10. Parrots Caught and Sold. One dawn in late July, Sunil found a fellow scavenger lying in the mud where Anawadi's rut road met the airport thoroughfare. Sunil knew the old man a little. He worked hard and slept outside the Merrill fish market half a mile away. Now the man's leg was mashed and bloody, and he was calling out to passersby for help. Sunil figured he'd been hit by a car. Some drivers weren't overly concerned about avoiding the trash pickers who scoured the roadsides. Sunil was too scared to go to the police station and ask for an ambulance, especially after what was rumored to have happened to Abdul. Instead, he ran toward the battleground of the Cargo Road dumpsters, hoping an adult would brave the police station. Thousands of people passed this way every morning. 2 hours later, when Rahul left Anawadi for school, the injured man was crying for water.
"This one is even drunker than your father," one of Rahul's friends teased him.
"Drunker than your father," Rahul retorted unimaginatively as they turned onto Airport Road.
Rahul wasn't afraid of the police. He'd run to them for help when his neighbor dumped boiling lentils on Dhanush, his sickly baby. The man on the road was just a scavenger, though, and Rahul had to catch a bus to class. When Zerunisa Hussein passed an hour later, the scavenger was screaming in pain. She thought his leg looked like hell, but she was bringing food and medicine to her husband, who also looked like hell, far across the city in the Arthur Road jail. Mr. Cumblay passed a little later, milky-eyed and aching, on his tour of businesses and charities, still seeking contributions for his heart valve. He had once been a pavement dweller like the injured man. Now Mr. Cumblay saw nothing but his own bottomless grief, because he knew miracles were possible in the new India, and that he couldn't have one. When Rahul and his brother returned from school in the early afternoon, the injured scavenger lay still, moaning faintly. At 2:30 p.m., a Shiv Sena man made a call to a friend in the Sahar police station about a corpse that was disturbing small children. At 4 p.m., constables enlisted other scavengers to load the body into a police van so that the constables wouldn't catch the diseases that trash pickers were known to carry. Unidentified body, the Sahar police decided, without looking for the scavenger's family. Died of tuberculosis, the Cooper Hospital morgue pathologist concluded, without an autopsy. Tokle, the police officer handling the case, wanted to move fast, for he had business with B.M. Patil Medical College in Bijapur. Its anatomy department required 25 unclaimed cadavers for dissection, and this one rounded out the order. A few days later, a young scavenger working in the rains discovered another body at the airport, a disabled man lying on an access road to the international terminal, a handmade crutch beside him. Unidentified, no autopsy. A third body turned up on the far side of the sewage lake, in a hole where people went to shit. Everyone using the open-air toilet had noticed that the smell was worse than usual. The decomposed body of an auto rickshaw driver named Odhen, though he too was marked unknown, his case of death recorded as illness. On airport scrubland across from the Hyatt, a fourth corpse turned up, head smashed flat, an Anawadi man who loaded luggage at the airport. Anawadian suspected that the one leg had left a curse and that the whole place was now ruined, rotten, barbad. There were rumors that Anawadi and the other airport slums would be demolished after parliamentary elections next year. Some Anawadians were confident that corporator Subhash Sawant could delay the arrival of the bulldozers. But at a nearby crisscross, a political poster flapped, suggesting that deals were being made.
You pretend you've hit me. I pretend I'm crying. You people who live on airport lands are familiar with this phony drama. Now, the other party says it will be the one to stop the airport from destroying your homes. So, why are they meeting in secret with the government and the developers?
Sunil was spooked by the deaths and the rumors, but of more immediate concern was the fact that his younger sister had grown another inch, increasing the height gap between them. In the monsoon, there wasn't nearly enough airport garbage to get him growing. He was never more dispirited than when he caught a glimpse of another scavenger boy from Anawadi, built like a blade of grass, lugging a sack so full that it bent him. This was Sonu Gupta, the blinky boy. He lived 7 huts down from Sunil and was 2 years older. A few years back, when scavenging at the airport had been less competitive, they'd worked the cargo road dumpsters together. A partnership that had ended when Sunil accidentally broke Sonu's nose. Lately, though, Sonu seemed to be signaling his forgiveness. Sunil sometimes found him loitering on their slum lane before dawn, a look of, let's work together, spreading over his face. The face itself was off-putting, wizened, with one of the blinky eyes rolling up. Sonu was half-deaf, too, and on hot days his nose spurted blood, some birth disorder that ran in his family. Sunil was old enough now to imagine what other boys would say should he renew such a substandard alliance. Still, he was curious about how the blinky boy secured so much trash. In any season, let alone the monsoon, bad eyesight was a serious disadvantage for a scavenger. One day, Sunil followed Sonu as he worked. He was surprised to find that a kid with no friends in Anawadi possessed profitable relationships outside it, chiefly with the security guards at one entrance of the vast Air India compound. In the pre-dawn darkness, Sonu waited outside a set of gates on Cargo Road, a tatty broom in hand. Eventually, an Air India guard let him in, and he began to sweep with comical fury. He cleaned the walkways, the security kiosk, the walkways again, erasing the trace of his small footprints, bending so low that he inhaled the whirl of his sweeping. It was a display so abject that Sunil felt prepared to disdain it, until the guard emptied 2 large trash cans at Sonu's feet. Then Sunil saw the cunning. In the middle of unruly, cutthroat Cargo Road, a slight teenaged boy had all to himself, behind security gates, a wealth of plastic cups, Coke cans, ketchup packets, and aluminum foil trays from a canteen where Air India workers ate. Somehow, his pathetic aspect, Blinky Sonu had achieved with the compound's guards what Sunil had failed to achieve with the rich women who came to the orphanage. Sonu had distinguished himself from the raggedy mass. Soon, only a little embarrassed, Sunil was walking out of Anawadi beside him. Sunil had to shout at Sonu to be heard, and at first he barely bothered. A monosyllabic routine was sufficient for their days, sweeping at Air India, trying to secure bottles and trash from the managers of beer bars and food joints, then splitting up to cover more ground. Sunil excelled at scaling walls and running from airport guards who caught him too close to the terminal. Sonu had no interest in being beaten by guards. His skills were consistency and systematic planning. He'd paid the Air India guards to give him trash the first time, but then they'd stopped asking for money. The scavengers Sonu supplanted at Air India had beaten him up and still cursed him when their paths crossed. But Sonu, having been a mockery magnet all his life, didn't worry about other people's opinions. Finishing his daily rounds, he'd stand on airport road facing traffic, tightening the strings of his fat sack with crisp tugs, his whole body radiating pride.
"You've taught me how to do this properly,"
Sunil told Sonu one day. Sonu was kind enough to split their earnings down the middle, most days 40 rupees or $1 each. They started to talk more as they worked, first little stuff, that toes were almost as useful as fingers for judging the recyclability of goods, that Sonu's family owned a radio that shocked your hand when you turned up the volume. Then bigger stuff, for Sonu liked to give concise lectures as he scavenged. Imbibing water from the sewage lake gives you jaundice, he argued, against Sunil's contention that teasing people with jaundice gives you jaundice. Sonu also advised against any involvement with male tourists who stayed in the luxury hotels, given what had happened to his little brother. He suggested that Sunil might want to brush his teeth more than once in 1,000 years, since his breath smelled worse than that of the slum's rotten food-eating pigs. One day, at the Mitti River, Sonu found a cigarette stub before Sunil could pocket it. Crouching, Sonu began to bash the precious stub with a stone. The tobacco came out, the filter shredded, and he nodded toward to the pulverized remains.
"If I see you smoke again, Sunil, I will beat you with a stone like this."
Sonu objected with equal passion to Sunil's fascination with Kallu, the garbage thief who acted out movies for the benefit of boys who could not afford to see them.
"You stay up half the night listening to this Kallu, and I have to waste so much time trying to get you up the next morning," Sonu complained.
Sonu didn't understand oversleeping. He pointed out,
"Every morning, my eyes open on their own."
Sunil was unused to being worried over, and liked it. Sonu's father was a more colorful drunk than Sunil's father. Occasionally, he tore up the rupee note he'd earned that day doing road work, saying,
"Fuck this! What does money matter?"
Sonu was fortunate in his mother, though. At night, she and her 4 children pulled the stringy manufacturing remnants from pink plastic clothespins, piecework for a nearby factory. During the day, she sold packets of ketchup and tiny jars of jam past their expiration date on a sidewalk near the Hotel Leela. Airline catering companies had donated the jam, along with plastic-wrapped packets of cake crumbs, to Sister Paulette for her needy young wards. Instead, the nuns sold the expired goods to poor women and children, who in turn tried to resell them. Sonu resented Sister Paulette even more than Sunil did. Sonu was enrolled in 7th grade at Merrill Municipal. Though he couldn't go to class because of his work, he registered for school annually, studied at night, and returned at year's end to take exams. Sonu thought Sunil should do the same. One morning, he cocked his head as if to drain the deafness from his ear and announced,
"Educate ourselves, and we'll be making as much money as there is garbage."
"You will be boss," Sunil said, laughing, "and I'll be the poor people, okay?"
"But don't you want to be something, Motu?" Sonu asked.
Sonu had taken to calling Sunil Motu, fatty, a description that fits Sunil only in relation to Sonu. Sunil did want to be something, but it didn't seem to him that a municipal school education gave Anawadi boys better opportunities. Those who finished 7th or 8th grade just ended up scavenging, doing road work, or boxing Fair and Lovely lotion in a factory. Only boys who went to private schools had a chance to finish high school and go to college. When Sunil and Sonu returned to Anawadi from their garbage gathering, they stopped talking, and their hips no longer bumped together as they walked. They were skinny kids making a little money. Prey. Older boys slapped down the wet road, and suddenly Sunil and Sonu were facing a pile drive, getting a noseful of buffalo shit. A son of Robert the Zebra Man offered them protection from the older boys for 30 or 40 rupees a week. When they didn't pay, he pummeled them himself. Sunil envied those children who seemed to have more than their share of protection. It was understood that a Shiv Sena gang would kick the ass of anyone who messed with Asha's kids, so no one did. The Hussein children had another sort of backing, a family the size of a cricket team. The Hindu boys said that Muslims fucked constantly in order to make enough babies to outnumber the Hindus. Sunil considered big families of any religion a fine thing, since all he really had was the overgrown irritant Sunita. Kallu, the garbage thief, looked out for Sunil when he was around, though Kallu was pretty small himself. Late in the afternoon, he sometimes joined Sunil on a warm pile of rubble at the far side of the sewage lake, where the slant of light before dusk made the shadows of both boys gigantic. Here, well out of the blinky boy's sight lines, Sunil could enjoy his daily cigarette in peace. Kallu smoked too, despite the tuberculosis he'd contracted a few years earlier. The two boys liked studying Anuwadi from a hidden vantage across the water. From the rocks, they could see how crazy lopsided all the huts were against the straight lines of the Hyatt and Meridian hotels that rose up behind them. It was as if the huts had fallen out of the sky and gotten smushed upon landing. The other marvels on the far side of the lake were a little farm that felt like a secret in the city, and a jamun fruit tree where parrots nested. Some of the other road boys had been capturing the parrots one by one to sell at the Merrill market, but Sunil brought Kallu around to the belief that the birds should be left as they were. Sunil listened for their squawks when he got up each morning, to make sure they hadn't been abducted in the night. Sunil thought of Kallu as the parrot of road boys, although the older boy had recently seen subdued. Even the movies he enacted were growing darker. Kallu's expertise was in the recycling bins inside airline catering compounds. Private waste collectors emptied these dumpsters on a regular basis, but Kallu had mastered the trash truck schedules. The night before pickup, Kallu would climb over the barbed wire fences and raid the overflowing bins. He'd managed to secure discarded aluminum serving trays from inside Chef Air, Dodge Catering, Oberoi Flight Services, and Sky Gourmet. The Oberoi dumpsters, he said, had been the most ferociously defended. Kallu's routine had become known by the local police, however. He kept getting caught until some constables proposed a different arrangement. Kallu could keep his metal scrap if he'd pass on information he picked up on the road about local drug dealers. A white-suited cocaine dealer named Ganesh Anna did a galloping business at the airport, and twice a week sent some of his distributors, Anuwadi men in their early 20s, to pick up the bulk cocaine in another suburb. Though Ganesh Anna paid the police to stay off his back, the constables weren't satisfied with their cut. In return for good information about the time and place of drug buys, they would leave Kallu's trash pilferings alone. Kallu kept a scrap of paper with the officer's cell phone numbers in the side pocket of his cargo pants, red and brown camouflage, Mirchi cast-offs. Kallu was equally afraid of the police and of Ganesh Anna. He felt like bait fish. He kept bringing up the film Prem Pratigya, in which a slum hoodlum feels so trapped by his life that he decides to kill himself with liquor, at which point the glorious Madhuri Dixit saunters to the rescue. Kallu routinely struck out with the girls who waited at the water taps, and both he and Sunil thought it unlikely that any new girl would appear, Madhuri-style, to extricate him from this entanglement. Getting out of Mumbai was the safer bet, and his estranged father had offered him a plausible escape. His father and elder brother, itinerant pipefitters, had a hut in a nearby slum that hung perilously onto a hillside. Kallu sometimes cried about how unwanted he'd felt in that home before he came to live on the road outside Anuwadi.
"I grew up in a second when my mother died," he told Sunil. "My father and brother didn't understand me."
Being misunderstood was better than being trapped between a drug dealer and the police, however. His father and brother were decamping for a construction project in the hill country near Karjat, 2 hours away from Anuwadi. Kallu had learned to pipefit as a child, and there would be work on the site for him, too. Sunil wished Kallu didn't have to go. Anuwadi would lose a lot of its color without him. It would lose the dramatic, hip-propelled reenactments of Om Shanti Om and the subtler entertainment of Kallu's hair, which changed in accordance with his favorite movies. Recently, he'd grown it long and lank, like the crazy college boy played by Salman Khan in that old film Tere Naam. Moreover, thieves like Kallu had status that garbage pickers lacked, and with Kallu's departure, Sunil would be more firmly fixed in his own identity as a scavenger, like Sonu the Blinky Boy, the kind of person other people allowed to suffer unaided and die alone on the road. A few days before leaving, Kallu told Sunil,
"My real name is Deepak Rai. Don't tell anyone. Also, my main god is Ganpati."
He thought Ganpati, the elephant god, the remover of obstacles,